One of the biggest scientific events of the year is coming to southern Illinois next month, a total solar eclipse.
This is a profoundly beautiful event. This is the moon completely blocking the face of the sun. It actually starts to get dark out. Crickets will chirp, birds will come out and sing, sort of twilight afternoon events happening in the middle of the day.
Head science writer for Bill Nye the Science Guy's Netflix show joins us. Plus, we talk with the man behind the mask in the new Spider-Man movie, stunt double Chris Silcox. But first, we'll revisit one part of our series on news fatigue, exploring where people turn to escape or process the news. Today, we discuss the role of podcasts.
How does other media fit in? How does music fit in? How does TV fit in? How do movies fit in? And I think that as many topics as there are in those other in that other media, you can find them in podcasting too.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. Today we revisit one part of our ongoing series on news fatigue, where we ask what people are listening to, reading, or watching to either get away from or process the news. We've talked about what books to read, what TV shows to watch. Today we're going to talk about podcasts. Back in April, Nyla Boodoo spoke with Lauren Ober, the host of The Big Listen from WAMU and NPR, and Nick Kwa, who writes a newsletter about podcasts called Hot Pod and contributes podcast reviews for Vulture.
Hey, Lauren. Hey, Nick. Thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for having me.
Lauren, let's start with you, because as we've been doing this ongoing series on news fatigue, I mentioned books, TV. I feel like podcasts are, of course, still having this moment where everyone's talking about the golden age of podcasting and everybody and their mother has a podcast, or I should say everybody and their nephew, right?
The moms have them too.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure.
So how are you seeing, I wonder how you're seeing podcasts at this moment fitting into people's daily lives?
I mean, I think it's across the board, right? Like how does other media fit in? How does music fit in? How does TV fit in? How do movies fit in? And I think that as many topics as there are in those other in that other media, you can find them in podcasting too. So if you want to get your political diet solely through podcasts, you can. If you want to follow all your trash TV, also in podcast form, if you want to listen to a fan podcast or something about the Real Housewives, you can do that too. And I think that, whatever topic you're into, podcasts will fill that, assuming that, you know, that's the medium that you want to consume.
Yeah, Nick, and what do we know? What have we seen in the past couple of months about, I don't know, I mean, we're going to get to S-Town in a minute, right? Because, of course, S-Town has now, like, broken all new podcast download records. But where are we at in terms of how many of consumption, sort of daily consumption of people and podcasts and where they fit into kind of everyday listening for folks?
Well, that's a really good question. And I think there are two versions of the answer to this that I think that is the most famous at this point. The first answer would be the ones that podcast publishers want you to sort of media type that you consume in between other stuff or while you're doing something else. So like commutes, while you're cooking in the kitchen, so on and so forth. But I think the second answer, which is something that I've come around to feeling that this is what the real sort of niche or novel value that podcast has, is it creates this really very, very sort of hermetic space in terms of a media experience. I think with television, with broadcast radio, with the internet especially, it feels that you're plugged into a much wider, chaotic world. But with on-demand audio specifically, it feels like you're creating very quiet, private spaces for yourself. And I think that ends up being what I see a lot of people responding to, particularly with the sort of recent string of new releases and recent string of developments in terms of programming.
Let's dive into recommendations, starting with the most popular one. Nick, you recommended S-Town. It comes from the makers of This American Life and Serial. Everybody's talking about it in its first week. It was like a record download 16 million times. We have a clip from the first episode. You're going to hear the main character, Macklemore, being interviewed by Brian Reed. Don't worry, there's no spoilers here. Let's take a listen.
You know, I have this old crummy Ford truck. You can't be a redneck and live in Alabama without a damn Ford truck, can you? And I keep thinking, could I put everything that I would put in that truck and drive down that driveway for the last time? But then again, who'd take care of Mama? Who'd feed the puppies? You know, who'd water the flowers? Who'd prune the maize? You must think I'm just totally nuts at this point.
No, I understand. It's home.
I'm sorry if I got off subject and all that. You know,
no, it's all good. Well, I can point you back to it a little bit. Why do you think it's important to try and figure out what happened with this?
I believe we have a genuine murder that resulted from some kids probably picking on a boy that defended himself. That's almost certainly been covered up.
Okay, so that's a clip from S-Town on public radio. We cannot say what the S in S-Town stands for. Nick, what do you think about S-Town?
Oh, my goodness. It's gorgeous. It's beautiful. Personally, it's sort of the most rewarding and probably the best thing I've heard ever, like, ever, probably. It's a gorgeous sort of novelist thing.
So, sorry, wait, did you say the best thing you've ever heard ever?
I will say it's the best thing I've ever heard. I'm unambiguous about that. I'm very, very honest about that. I'm surprised. Like, it's gorgeous. It's incredibly ambitious. It is so thoughtful, so perfect at such a high level. I don't think that something like this is ever possible. But it is absolutely gorgeous.
Lauren, what do you think about S-Town?
You know, I found myself.
It is. You do not
all,
think it's the best thing you've ever
no,
heard.
No, no. You know, I do. I mean, the interesting thing about it is that they've made this miraculous piece of audio or this audio story without truly having a plot. You know, I mean, you're hooked in because, you know, you think that there's sort of this investigation. It has this like true crime-esque kind of thing, just like its predecessor Serial did, but then of course it isn't about that at all, and really it's in the writing, and it's in the sound design, it's in the character development, and it really is beautiful. And I think in terms of form, you know, creating something that is more novel-esque or more literary is really sort of boundary breaking in podcasting.
Mm-hmm.
I think what's further interesting about that is the way in which the show very much grapples with the conventions of radio and attempts to systematically break a lot of things. And I think that was the only way into the story that it could find. It's a bit of a sort of a construction of a miracle. Like, from an architectural mechanical perspective, there's no way in which this should have worked. But the fact that they sort of lean into all those rule breaking principles, I think that's the only way they were able to string this along.
And it doesn't help, or excuse me, it doesn't hurt that it came from Serial and This American
sure.
Life, where you know
right,
there's
right.
a history of quality. I think if this had been attempted by somebody else, you know, we might not even be putting our ears on it at all.
Yeah, that's an
Absolutely.
Interesting point,
yeah.
Lauren. Lauren, let's go to something else. A music podcast that you recommended. It's called Song Exploder. Musicians bit by bit break down their songs. We wanted to play a short clip from an episode where Solange talks about how she wrote her hit song Cranes in the Sky. She's just arrived in Miami. This is anybody who lands in Miami. This is the first thing you actually see, which is cranes everywhere. Let's hear Solange.
Literally everywhere that I looked around had a crane in the sky, and you could not look at a street without dozens and dozens of them. And it just felt really heavy, and that line immediately came to me.
Well, it's like cranes in the sky. Sometimes I don't want to feel those metal clouds.
So that's from the podcast Song Exploder, hosted by Hrishikesh Hirway. Lauren, how does this show affect the way you think about music?
Well, first of all, I feel like I have gotten completely overwhelmed with music lately. I used to go to, you know, record stores, and I used to flip through albums, and I haven't done that in years, and I get totally overwhelmed trying to wade through Spotify or iTunes. And Song Exploder is amazing because it takes all of these songs, both popular and ones you know that are totally obscure, and it breaks them down into their component parts. So you're getting more than just here's a lovely song to listen to. It's actually the artists themselves breaking down how they constructed them, and you get this sort of, you know, you see a little bit how the sausage is made, which is kind of a blessing and a curse, because maybe you don't want it's music feels like magic to me, and I don't always want to know how the magic trick works, but I think that there's a lot of value added to that or that that podcast gives.
Well, it's interesting that you say that about not wanting to know how it works, because, Nick, one of your recommendations for another podcast is On Being with Krista Tippett. And what I think is so interesting about the podcast is that she does sort of like this unfiltered thing where right. you can listen to the whole raw thing rather than the very published product that is the show that airs on public radio stations.
Yes. And it's like, I really do enjoy the unedited ones a lot more than the polished versions, because I think one of the more gorgeous things about, you know, interview podcasts specifically, especially those that are allowed to be a bit more sort of fuzzy and hairy and sort of a little bit more itself, is that you hear people really try to work things out. And I think that is such that's like a real gift to sort of listen to a conversation in which, you know, both sides, it's not particularly performative. It's actually two people really trying to search for an answer in the questions that they're either asking or being asked. And I think Krista Tippett does that very, very in a wonderful way. And yeah, it's sort of like, I'm always sort of, I always marvel at human conversation, and I really like it when it's unedited.
It's really interesting because I've shifted all of my listening and I only listen to the podcast now. I never really listened to it on air, for On Being. So I think it's interesting for you, Nick, like, what do you think makes the show most relevant to you right now? Is it just that it's that very human conversation?
Well, it's a human conversation, but it's also the sort of the project. Like, the whole concept around On Being is to have these conversations about really, really big stuff, like human existence, what it means to be alive, so on and so forth. And I'm personally sort of a news junkie. Like, I live on Twitter. I'm, like, very, very granularly oriented and trying to figure out what's happening. It sort of makes me a bit blind to the larger questions that, like, I would like to be asking more. And so, like, I typically reserve On Being listening to, like, you know, my Saturday evenings where I'm, like, taking a walk, so that I have this sort of space to reconnect to these larger, larger questions. And in a way that's guided, in a way that's sort of through a vessel that I trust, and the vessel being Krista Tippett, the interviewer. She has a wonderful Rolodex of guests and just a wonderful mind in the way she works through certain problems and conversations. It's come to be a really big part of my weekends these days.
So from the very big ideas to celebrity, I want to go to Lauren, one of your recommendations, which is Who Weekly. And the tagline is everything you need to know about celebrities you don't. Lauren, tell us about that one.
So
we're going all over here.
I know we're, you know, it's highbrow, lowbrow over here. So Who Weekly is, like you said, a celebrity podcast, but hosted by two extremely smart folks, Bobby Finger and, oh my gosh, Lindsay. It's hosted by two amazing folks who are writers, Bobby and Lindsay. They love celebrity culture, and they love deconstructing celebrity culture, and they love poking fun at it. But at the end of the day, I mean, they always have sort of respect for the celebrity hustle, and it's just so clever. And the conceit is really, the world of celebrity is divided into who's and them's. And the who is like the, wait, who is that person again? And the them is, you know, like a Tom Cruise, somebody that everybody knows. And I just, they're so clever and thoughtful and whip smart. I mean, they're so quick. And it's just, it's breezy. That is the thing that I listen to when I'm going, when I'm driving in the car somewhere. And I have an hour or two, and I just download a bunch of their episodes and sort of mainline them.
Okay. And so it's Bobby Finger. Is it Lindsay Weber? Is she?
Yeah. So Who Weekly is hosted by Lindsay Weber and Bobby Finger, who are two amazing writers.
Nick, one of your other recommendations was Bodega Boys. Can you tell us about that?
I'm also getting a recommendation because I'm curious whether you guys have actually shouting them out in public radio. Bodega Boys is an extremely profane and raunchy sort of pop culture show.
Yeah, I follow them on Twitter. So I've like, at least I feel like they're like my social media people, these guys. So
I love them so much. It's hosted by two comedians, two sort of like personalities, two men of color from the Bronx, Desus and Kid Mero. And the Bodega Boys, it's this sort of really chaotic, raucous conversation in which these two comedians sort of like catch up with stuff that's happened on the week. Usually political and pop culture, sometimes personal. But it's, you know, I listen to it largely as just a meditation space. I like putting it on the back.
Right next to Krista Tippett?
Right next to Krista. It's like a little strange because they are so joyous and like happy to be alive. And this was celebratory in a very defiant way. And I feel like I'm generally a very sort of paranoid, scared person when I walk out on the street in general, anywhere, wherever I am. And so I listen to Bodega Boys in the background just to sort of like give me that sort of vibe. Like I treat it almost as music. It's just sort of this feeling that it gets me into. Like a fun fact is that I'm really afraid of flying, and I often listen to Bodega Boys on loop in plane flights because it just kind of amps me up and gets me through that experience.
As opposed to an actual meditation app. That's hilarious. That's great.
That's okay.
So I would be remiss in saying, of course, we're almost out of time, but the other broadcast radio show that you should listen to is Lauren's. It's called The Big Listen. It's a production of WAMU and NPR in Washington, D.C. You can catch that in podcast format. I also want to thank Nick Kwa. He writes a newsletter about podcasts called Hot Pod. You can subscribe to that. He also contributes to podcast reviews for Vulture. Lauren, Nick, thanks for being with me.
Oh, thanks. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
First is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, showing and preserving significant collections and digitally archiving irreplaceable information so that it is forever accessible to students, faculty, and the community at large. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. You know, a lot of discussion around the topic of healthcare is centered around one idea. It's how can we reduce costs while improving care and improving outcomes? That's largely the driving force behind an effort launched in Illinois to overhaul the way Medicaid operates. That's the federal and state health insurance program for low-income residents, children, people with disabilities. And ever since 2015 in the state, Illinois law has required that at least half of those enrolled in what's called a Medicaid-managed care plan. The goal is to improve patients' health while costing taxpayers less. But a new report from Crane's Chicago Business found that the program isn't reaching many of the people it's supposed to. Learn more about what their investigation uncovered. I'm joined now on the line from Chicago by Crane's healthcare reporter, Kristen Schorsch. Kristen, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you for having me.
So this gets complicated, and we'll talk more about that here in a minute, but basically your story gets at a number of problems that are keeping Illinois Medicaid's program from meeting those goals that we talked about there in the intro, and one of the biggest seems to be that the private insurers being paid by the state can't find many of the people they're supposed to be helping. What's going on there?
Right. Well, so there are a number of factors to this. So, right, so they are supposed to find or essentially contact all the enrollees that they get each month. Just to give them a basic healthcare assessment, do you need to go to the doctor? Do you have high blood pressure? Do you have diabetes? How can we help you stay healthy so that we can, you know, the goal being to save the state money and Medicaid overall.
Yeah, that kind of preventive care can reduce costs and improve people's health in the long term.
Right. A huge focus is on prevention. But, you know, the health insurance companies were telling me that, you know, some of the problems that they have is that, you know, each month they are given a huge list of new enrollees, so say thousands of members. And so they, you know, start trying to find them. But one of the things about this population is that, you know, people on Medicaid are low income and disabled, and they are often often hard to find. They can be homeless. They don't have a permanent address or a phone number. They cycle in and out in what's known as churn as their income fluctuates. So right off the bat, I mean, this is a difficult population to reach. So not only do you have that, but then within the rules or contracts with the states, they're told their pay to focus on people who are deemed as being the highest risk, the most expensive, the sickest population.
So like a triage approach to it.
Right. So when you have those requirements in place, yet you're supposed to be finding all of your enrollees, it makes it really difficult to do the jobs.
What about the funding for this? I mean, how is it the state is paying for, can you describe sort of the funding model for this and how the insurers are paid?
Sure. So the state, the health plans are essentially paid a fixed amount of money per enrollee per month. So they start out with that fixed amount. So the idea being that if you are able to keep your enrollees healthy, focus on prevention, get them on the medications they need, that you can stay within that amount of money and even save the state money. But in addition to that, the state of Illinois also withholds each month so a percentage of that money so that to encourage these insurance companies
an
to
incentive
hit quality
or a,
metrics. Mm. Right. So, you know, making sure that kids are getting their immunizations on time, making sure that women are getting mammograms, all these preventative goals, because you want to encourage people to use healthcare. You want to keep them healthy, focus on prevention. So when I was asking the state, you know, those same questions, well, how do you know the insurance companies aren't just profiting off of this program?
Right.
What if they just don't find people so they don't
or don't try to find them? Yeah.
Right. And so their response was, well, we know that people are hitting the ERs, hitting the hospitals, because we can't find these folks, they're still using healthcare. And then you've got that carrot and stick approach from the state, which is tying incentives to making sure they hit these quality benchmarks. So the insurance companies are losing money by not hitting some of those measures.
Hmm. So, I mean, lots more to dig in there. But just for a minute, can we kind of step back? And we've talked about the complicated terms here, but can we define our terms a little bit? I mean, we're talking about managed care, specifically Illinois' Medicaid program and how that's set up, which is somewhat different from some other places. Can you just explain that, you know, what managed care is and how it kind of applies here in Illinois to Medicaid?
Right. So if you think about people who get their insurance through work, so say you have a Blue Cross plan, you know, they control which doctors and hospitals you go to. They set up this network and which you go to for, you know, for a discounted price. In managed care in Illinois, what the state is doing is they are largely outsourcing the management, the administration of the benefits for Medicaid enrollees to private health insurance companies. About two-thirds of Medicaid recipients in Illinois are now essentially covered by these private health plans, Blue Cross, Aetna, County Care, which is run by the Cook County Health System. And so these health plans set up their networks of doctors and hospitals, and they are essentially tasked with overseeing your care. But in this situation for Medicaid, because the state wants to save money and boost quality, they hold these health insurance companies to standards, the ones we talked about before, these quality benchmarks that they want them to hit. And so that way, the idea is that they incent the health plans to make sure that they are focusing on prevention with their enrollees, and at the same time, trying to get them out of the ER, out of the hospital, steering them towards a doctor's office so that they stay healthy in the long run and work with teams of providers if they run into trouble. Maybe they need housing. Maybe they need food. There are elements beyond healthcare that they might need in their lives.
Yeah, so sort of expanding that a little bit. So in Illinois, about just over 3 million, 3.2 million or so Illinois Medicaid recipients, two-thirds of those are enrolled in a managed care plan. You had talked earlier about some of what you're hearing from the insurers. You talked to a number of them and a number of different groups who are trying to reach out. You know, what are the things you're hearing from them, and what sort of shift is happening? Are they looking at different tools or different ways or methods to try to reach more people?
Right. So one of the things that some of them are doing, and the state is encouraging more of this, is to work with organizations that are experts in finding the homeless populations, people who might have a behavioral health issue. So, for example, Aetna is working with the AIDS Foundation of Chicago. They already do case management for people who have HIV and AIDS. So each month, the AIDS Foundation gets a list of enrollees from Aetna, and these are people that Aetna's already tried to find and can't. And so the AIDS Foundation of Chicago will send out teams of people to canvas neighborhoods, knock on doors, talk to neighbors, really try and make a personal connection, a face-to-face connection, to just ask, like, hey, how are you doing? Do you can we ask you a few questions about your health to see if we need to hook you up with a doctor? Some of these health insurance plans are also working with Thresholds, which is a nonprofit that provides, that connects to people who have a mental illness with housing and jobs. And the Heartland Health Outreach, another nonprofit, wants to get more deeply involved with health plans and is really interested in doing that. They are a provider of health care for the homeless population. So there are different ways that the health insurance companies are trying to find more people and connect with them, but the state is encouraging more of that since the governor is overhauling this Medicaid managed care program and is in the process of rebidding it. So the insurance companies that have contracts with the state now might not going forward.
Okay, so some different models there and sort of partnering and collaborating with other community organizations that already have some of these relationships. We're talking with Kristen Shores, healthcare reporter with Crane Chicago Business, about the recent article just out this week, taking a look at some of the health plans, the Medicaid plans. Private insurers are struggling to find the people who are enrolled in those programs here in Illinois. That could be costing money, people falling through the cracks, many different outcomes from all of that. You know, I mean, one thing that we have to talk about here, the state has gone, had gone more than 2 years without a budget until last Thursday. You know, there's a backlog. Medicaid insurers are owed billions of dollars, excuse me. How has all that played into this?
Right. Well, I mean, that's another pain point. You know, if you think about the domino effect of this, if the health plans are owed $3 billion and they're trying to make their finances work, then they're slowing or stopping payments to doctors who are then potentially blocking access to patients. Aetna and Meridian are two health plans that have already threatened to leave the state Medicaid program altogether. Aetna, for example, is owed $698 million.
Wow.
And so obviously, you can see if they're not getting paid, they can't flow that money down to the doctors and then ultimately to the patients to provide health care. So this budget crisis has really impacted the health plans, and we're just going to kind of have to wait and see if the money can get to them fast enough since we do not have a budget.
All right. Well, you can read much more about this in Crane's Chicago Business. Kristen Shores' article just came out earlier this week. We will tweet a link to that. You can follow us at 21st Show. Kristen, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to The 21st.
So, to become an Avenger, are there, like, trials or an interview?
Do me a favor.
Can't you just be a friendly neighborhood Spider-Man?
Just
stay close to the ground.
You're the Spider-Man from YouTube.
From YouTube. This is the voice of Peter Parker in there, played by Tom Holland from the new movie Spider-Man Homecoming. But it's not Tom Holland behind the mask in many of the most dangerous scenes of the biggest movie at the box office this weekend. It's actor and stuntman Chris Silcox. Who just happens to be a graduate of the University of Illinois. Chris joins us now by phone. Chris, welcome to the 21st.
Hey, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing all right. So in this movie, I mean, Spidey's slammed into a bus. He's dragged down a street, flipping in midair, slamming through glass. Is there a scene that you perform that kind of stands out to you from this movie?
Well, you know, the whole movie is a really big cookie-cutter puzzle of me, two other stunt doubles, and Tom Holland. So any scene you see, it could be actually any one of us. We're matched up with Tom as much as possible just so that it looks as much like Tom when we do stuff. The things that I did the most in were probably on the ferry crossing New York Harbor and in the ATM fight. We have a fight against four guys in Avengers masks.
In the masks, right.
We put together all of those fight scenes in rehearsals for a long time, and then we shot them shot by shot, and then reshot them. And, I would say those I have the most screen time in, along with little things here and there.
So for us, you know, we watch that, it plays out, you know, in a couple of minutes, but you've described a process there. I mean, take us behind the scenes just briefly about, you know, what goes into sort of putting together a scene like that where, you know, at one point, if I'm remembering right, Spider-Man is hanging from the ceiling. They're trying to get into the ATM, and he drops down and kind of takes over.
Mm-hmm. We get the scripts from the director months in advance. The stunt coordinator has it several months before he's even chosen who is going to be the stunt doubles. And we got there, we started shooting in June last year, and we got there in about April to start rehearsing and putting together things, because everything that happens in the film, even if it needs to be computer generated, it needs to be done practically. So every single thing, every hit by the bus, every hit by the car, every jump over the wall, every flip around needs to be done practically somehow, so that production knows that it can be done when we get
so
to the
day. So even if it's something that's going to be computer generated, somebody like you or one of the others has to physically go through that.
Yeah, yeah, we have to actually do it. So we put on a bunch of pads, we put mats all around, we actually hit the ground, get hit by the vehicle, get hit every, you know, jump over the thing, get attached to a wire, slide up, you know, or get wrenched up into the air that high. It's all done practically, because the director and even the visual effects coordinator would prefer everything to be done practically, because it just makes his job easier, because we're already there, and it looks better, you know? You can tell the difference.
It's interesting to hear the way you described as so nonchalant. Oh, and then I get hit by the bus, and then I get taken. It's just like another day at the job. You know, I mean, you studied, you know, theater here in Urbana when you were at the U of I. You were a competitive gymnast, just happened to be almost exactly the same size as Tom Holland, you know, the guy who plays Spider-Man in this movie. Are you a comic, a superhero fan at all?
I was a huge Batman fan growing up, actually. I had a Batman cape that I used to run around in when I was a kid. I wouldn't take it off. My mom hated it.
I was going to ask what it was like to put on the Superman costume, but maybe I should ask, what was it like to play alongside Michael Keaton?
Oh, yeah. That's a trip, huh? Isn't having Batman there in your midst? I grew up watching him. He was my first idol. I watched that movie over and over and over again. So that was surreal. And then seeing how cool he is and how professional he is, you'd think somebody that has that amount of fame would not be very nice to be around. But he was as nice dealing with people behind the sets as he was when he was slamming your head into a car.
And threatening to kill you and your family and everything else in the movie.
Yeah, and then checking up on you the next day to see if your head was okay.
Your head was all right.
He's great.
And what about the Spider-Man? So, I mean, you put that mask on the first time, you kind of step up. This is the Spider-Man movie. That's got to be energizing.
Oh, yeah, it's epic. There's no better feeling in the world, and it's equally matched by the amount of people's eyes that are on you, because it's like, you know, it's like Mickey Mouse just walked into the room. It's like nobody nobody can take their eyes off you, and it's just surreal, and it's really funny to just be in there from behind the suit, and you feel the, you know, the legend of the suit and the power that it has, and you instantly have enough adrenaline to do whatever it needs.
Whatever,
you know?
It takes, yeah. Well, we're talking here with Chris Silcox, stunt double actor from Spider-Man Homecoming. We've only got here about 15 seconds left, but, I mean, what's next for you? Do you have other projects in the works? Where else can people see your acting?
Yeah, I'm going to do a film this summer. I'm going to do some stunts and some acting work in it, and we did just finish a film called The Greatest Showman, which is actually really fun because there's a lot of gymnastics and circus in it. It's with Hugh Jackman and Zac Efron and Zendaya, funnily enough.
Nice. All right, some more big names there. Well, Chris Silcox, thank you very much. University of Illinois grad. Go see him in Spider-Man Homecoming. It was the biggest movie at the box office last week. Look for that again this week. But thank you very much. It was good to talk to you.
Thanks, Scott. Appreciate it, man.
Coming up next, we'll talk with a bad astronomer, blogger, head science writer for Bill Nye Saves the World on Netflix, about the eclipse, the total solar eclipse that's coming now, about a month away. And one of the best places to be will be right here in southern Illinois. Stay with us. This is The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Scott Cameron, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Next month's total solar eclipse is the first of its kind in almost 40 years, and southern Illinois, as we've been talking about, will be one of the best spots in the world to see it. Ahead of the August 21st event, Phil Plait, you might know him better as the Bad Astronomer, will be in central Illinois today. He's an astronomer, blogger, head science writer for the Netflix show Bill Nye Saves the World. He'll be giving a talk at 7 tonight at the Champaign Public Library titled When the Moon Eats the Sun. The total eclipse of 2017. We'll tweet out all that information if you follow us at 21st Show and have it available on our website. He spoke recently with 21st host Nyla Boodoo.
Hey, Phil. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Phil, for I think people, especially in Illinois, the news has been building about the total eclipse. But maybe you can explain, why is this such a big deal?
Well, it's a big deal for a lot of reasons. One is that it's a rare phenomenon. You don't get a total solar eclipse in any particular spot on the Earth very often. Now, in general, they happen once or twice a year, but they're very specific. There might be one over Antarctica, over the Pacific Ocean. And so to have one over the continental United States hasn't happened in a long time and won't happen again for quite a few years. And the other reason is that this is a profoundly beautiful event. It's not just like a partial solar eclipse where the moon blocks a little bit of the sun. You wouldn't even notice that if you didn't know it was happening. This is the moon completely blocking the face of the sun. It actually starts to get dark out. Crickets will chirp. Birds will come out and sing, sort of twilight afternoon events happening in the middle of the day. And you also see the sun's atmosphere called the corona, which is not something you normally see. You only see it in pictures. And to be able to look and see that with your own eyes is an incredibly moving event. Or so I'm told, because I've never seen one. This will be my first.
I think this will be a first for a lot of people, right? If the first one was in 1979, or the most recent one was in 1979. Obviously, when you think about eclipses, there's a long history of people being fascinated by them, thinking of it as a, you know, before we knew more, before our scientific knowledge had evolved to where it is today. I think there were a lot of people who were obviously understandably very scared by them. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions still about eclipses, because you said you can look at it. And I wanted to ask you about that. What can you look at it? Is it safe to look at it? What other misconceptions do people maybe have about observing this eclipse?
Is it safe to look at it? Yes and no. We have to be careful here. The sun is very bright. Hello. I think everybody knows that. Looking at the sun for a split second isn't all that dangerous. Staring at it is not a good idea. Your eyes just really aren't built to handle that kind of light coming in very well. And it's even more dangerous for kids than adults. So you shouldn't do that. Once the sun is completely blocked by the moon, it's actually safe to look at because the moon is covering the entire bright surface of the sun. The problem comes in after about 2 minutes. Let me phrase it this way. The moon partially blocks the sun for about an hour and a half. That starts in Illinois at about 11:52. At 1:20 in the afternoon, the moon will completely block the sun, and it'll stay that way for about 2 minutes. It depends on where you are. And once that's over and the moon passes the sun again, that's the most dangerous part for looking at it, because when it's dark, your pupils open up, it lets in more light, and then once the moon moves off, the bright sunlight could in fact damage your eye. So here's what I suggest. Up until the eclipse is total, make sure you're using safe viewing circumstances, whether that's eclipse glasses rated for safety or looking through a telescope that's outfitted correctly. You can find all that sort of information online. Once it's total, you're fine to look at it, but make sure your timing is something you're paying attention to, and give it a good 30 seconds, you know, and then don't look at it again with your eyes. Use something that's safe to look at it. But during that totality, yeah, it's safe to look at, and I'm very excited about seeing this myself for the first time.
Phil, we have people listening from all over Illinois. So I wanted to ask you first, why is Carbondale, why is Southern Illinois one of the best viewing places in the world? And if you're in the northern part of the state, or if you're in, if you're you know, further north, or if you're further east or northeast, like if you're in Chicago, what will you see then?
What's going on here is that the moon orbits the Earth, and usually it doesn't get that close to the sun. But this time, everything is lined up just right so that the moon will pass directly in front of the sun. So basically what it's doing is it's casting its shadow on the Earth. And it just so happens that in the sky, the moon and the sun appear to be about the same size. It's a coincidence. But what that means is that if you're a little bit too far north or a little bit too far south, the moon won't completely block the sun. And so what you get is a partial eclipse. Now, the sun is mostly blocked, but you need to block all of it to see the total eclipse. So that means that you have to be in a very narrow band going across the United States. You have to be inside this region to be able to see it. So if you're, for example, if you're in, I'm looking at a map right now, Evansville, you're outside of the totality path. You're going to get a very close to total eclipse, like 99% of the sun will be blocked, but not total.
So how big is the window? How many miles is that?
In fact, the path of totality across the United States is pretty narrow. It's only about 60 miles wide. So if you're inside of that path, north of the southern region and south of the northern region of it, you'll get a total eclipse. And so if you're in Carbondale, Marion, I'm looking at the map right now of southern Illinois, Harrisburg, regions like that, you will see a total eclipse. Now, if you're right in the center of that path, that's going to maximize the length of time that the sun is blocked. And in fact, this is passing through northwestern United States and the southeastern United States. The amount, the length of time the sun is blocked changes depending on where you are. And Carbondale, that area, is pretty much the greatest duration that anybody will see from this eclipse. So honestly, this is the best place in the world to see it. And it will last for about 2 minutes and 40 seconds. I'm going to be in Wyoming to see it, and I only get 2 minutes and 9 seconds. So you all get 31 seconds more than I do.
Oh, you should come here.
Well, I wanted to find a place where I knew the weather was going to be good.
There you go. But
it could be cloudy, could be raining. You never know. You can't control that sort of thing. This is something astronomers have been putting up with for thousands of years. So, we're pretty stoic about it. But I'm hoping that Wyoming, which is typically very clear and dry in the summer, is going to be a place for me to see it.
My guest is Phil Plait. You may know him as the Bad Astronomer. He's a blogger and astronomer, as he's, of course, talking about. He's also the head science writer for the Netflix show Bill Nye Saves the World. And I wanted to ask you just really quickly about your work as the head writer. There's 13 episodes from season one that are now available on Netflix. One of the episodes is about chemtrails. Before we listen to clip, can you explain what chemtrails are?
Well, that episode is about pseudoscience. It's just about all kinds of different ways that our thinking goes wrong. And certainly a great example of that is this idea of chemtrails. Basically, you go outside, you look up, and you see these straight lines of clouds going across the sky. These are vapor trails. They're basically just condensation that happens as airplanes fly through the air. It's a very natural physical outcome, especially with jet engines. You get condensation going behind them. And we're used to seeing these things, but a lot of people think that they're actually not just water vapor. They're actually laced with chemicals for whatever reason. Some people think that the government's trying to control our minds or whatever's going on. And so we decided to send our science correspondent, Carly Kloss, to talk to an airplane pilot, about this and to go up and fly with him and take a closer look.
Let's listen to a clip for that episode. It's called Malarkey.
Chemical trails. Is there any truth behind this speculation? I decided to take my inquiry to Tori Ward, a commercial pilot with over 11,000 hours of flight experience and more than 80 types of aircraft. He should have a scientific explanation for what those mysterious streaks in the sky really are.
So, Tori, these long white lines that are left in the sky after a jet flies through the air, is there any truth to the theory that there's chemicals that are released by the government?
Absolutely not.
What about to control minds?
No, doesn't exist.
Zombies?
They are very much conspiracy theories. It is a condensation trail. Contrails are formed by generally aircraft at higher altitudes where the temperature is cold enough and also moist enough.
That's a clip from Bill Nye Saves the World. That episode is called Malarkey. Their head writer for it is with me now talking about science, the total eclipse that's supposed to be happening that's next month. He's in town, actually, this evening to be speaking in Champaign. Phil, you know, I think many adults today grew up with Bill Nye. He made science really cool. And what's your approach to this show in terms of the topics that you pick, making it both fun, entertaining, and educational?
Well, in fact, when they called me and asked me if I was interested in being a writer on the show, and of course I said yes, they said, what episodes, what sort of topics would you like to cover? And I off the top of my head, I ticked off a bunch of things. Let's talk about vaccines. Let's talk about pseudoscience. Let's talk about climate change. And it turns out that of the six or seven things I just thought of immediately, they would already had a list of those as potential topics. So it wasn't too hard to pick these. These are basically topics where either the science isn't necessarily clear on an important topic and is something that we should be talking about, or where the science is clear and people misunderstand it. And I thought that was a really great direction to go for a show headed by Bill Nye, who is not only a familiar face and somebody who knows a lot about the science of this, but is somebody who is passionate about science and about correcting misconceptions people might have.
Yeah, there's one episode about sex where Bill talks about the sexual spectrum. What was the goal of that episode?
This, of all the episodes, this was the one I was really interested in working on because it's not something I know a lot about, but I know some of our writers, we had a team of writers, by the way, including biologists and people who had expertise in a lot of different fields. And although, you know, I'm interested in this topic, the idea of gender and sex and how this all works biologically and how that affects society, it's not something I knew a lot about in detail. And we investigated this and were surprised to find out things like how fluid gender roles can be. And let me say, I'm distinguishing sex and gender as sex as being biological and gender being sort of the societal roles that we assign to these biologies. That's an oversimplification, but for now that'll do. And we found that a lot of countries, like, for example, in Korea, pop music is really far ahead. It's very progressive when it comes to fluidity of gender roles, where male and female overlap. And things that in the United States we might think of as being more masculine or more feminine are shared by both genders. And it was just really neat to see, although we think that human sexuality is very binary, it's you're male or female, that's not what biology tells us at all. In fact, there is a spectrum, and although most people might identify as male or female, that's not at all the case for everybody, and it was a real eye-opener for a lot of us, I think.
Yeah, I was just thinking as you were saying that there's a new Chinese boy band that's like they're trying to make the boy band of China and they're all young women. So to that point, it's just interesting. So next month you're going to be in Wyoming to observe the eclipse. What can people look forward to with your talk this evening?
Well, I'll be talking about a little bit about the history of eclipses and mostly about how they work and why they're so cool. You know, you just don't see these things very often. And when they happen, they're gorgeous, and it's not all the sorts of things you expect. It's like, oh, well, it's going to get a little dark, and that'll be it. It's like, oh, no. There's a whole lot of stuff going on here, really beautiful, a lot of things to look out for. And basically, I just want people to understand the nature of these things, that this is a beautiful and rare astronomical phenomenon, and that basically, if you can get a chance to go outside and see it, do it.
Phil Plait writes the Bad Astronomy blog. If you're in Champaign, he's going to be at the public library at 7 o'clock tonight. We'll tweet out all of that information. Phil, thanks so much for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Save the world. save the world, Bill Nye.
Well, that's it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Just search for The 21st, also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us, phone, email, social media, it's all on our website at 21stshow.org. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. I'm Scott Cameron. I've been sitting in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media.